a secret time in our lives. Time out of time. Together, but apart. Not together, I say with difficulty.
Have you told your family I'm here?
Of course not. He smiles and comes over and takes the platter out of my hands and places it up on the shelf I was straining to reach. He's Noah, so he doesn't simply come over and take the platter. He kind of saunters over. And when he reaches for it, his hand brushes against me very, very slightly. And then after he puts the platter up where it belongs, he stays there, standing so close I can see the little dots of stubble of his beard. Can feel his breathing as though it's my own breath he's taking. His eyes are on mine, and I know from the expression on his face what's going to happen next. He's going to lean down and kiss me. I brace myself against it. I think as hard as I can, no, 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 no. Then, to my surprise, he turns away and goes back to the table, where he picks up his phone and, giving me a short wave, leaves the house. The front door bangs behind him. I am shaking. I get a glass of water from the sink. A man in a window across the way is dancing. A man is dancing, and I am standing here drinking water, and somehow now I know that it is only a matter of time until Noah and I get to the kissing part. I have never wanted anybody more in my life. Jeremy calls me the next day on his way to work. I can tell I am on speakerphone in his car because I get to hear all the Jacksonville traffic, the whooshes of trucks going by, and the snippets of other people's radios as he passes them. I'm on my way to work, too, walking along Bedford Avenue to Best Buds, studying the people who are rushing past. "Hey, how are you?" I say when I pick up. As he always does, he plunges right into the list of things he's done since the last time we talked. Went for a swim last night, played checkers with his mom, had pork chops for dinner, went to bed early. How are the patients? Any good stories?
Well, Mrs. Brandon came in yesterday, and you know how it is. Poor thing, her sciatica is still bothering her, and she's blaming the treatment. So I asked her if she's taking the anti-inflammatory drugs, and she said she's not because they hurt her stomach. And I said she should take probiotics at the same time, and she said she'd heard of those, but never knew if they were safe.
Huh,
I say. Oh, but there's this. You'll be happy to know I got the carpets cleaned in the waiting room. Looks nice. A guy came in and said he could clean the whole office for $50, and I didn't know if that was a good deal or not, but I don't think the building management has cleaned the carpets in the entire time I've been there. Did you notice how soiled they were?
I'm afraid I didn't, I tell him.
Well, they're awful. I thought you would have noticed.
But sounds like they're clean now, I say.
Yes. Oh, yes.
I let a beat of silence go by. And then say, "Hey, guess what? I got a job."
You got a job? In Brooklyn? Why would you do that?
Because I think it'd be good for me to be out around people more. And this woman in a florist shop asked me if I wanted to work there because I was sort of talking to some customers there. And she... I stopped talking because I realize he's been trying to interrupt me the entire time.
No, I realize what a job will be like, he says. But what I'm wondering is, why are you embedding yourself in this community if you're going to leave soon?
Well, it's 3 months. I can work for 3 months, can't I?
I don't know. I thought you'd be busy getting the house ready to sell or something. Not going out and working in, what, a shop of some kind?
For a florist?
Yeah, a florist. You do realize I'm counting on you coming back, don't you?
He laughs, a stiff little chuckle that rings completely false. I told the woman that I'm only here until the end of the year, I tell him. Don't worry, I'm coming back.
Well, he says and pretends to growl, see that you do. because there's somebody on this call who's getting very, very lonely without his girlfriend around.
I toy with the idea of dropping my phone in the storm drain. After that, it takes a little bit to put this conversation back on solid ground again. He tells me the weather is still hot, that he hopes to go see Natalie and Brian tonight, that he thinks Amelia looks like me. And then he says brightly,
"Oh, I told my mom about our engagement. I know, we agreed not to tell everybody until later on, but she was so down the other night that I wanted to cheer her up. And it did. She was thrilled, over the moon. Oh, you know what? I've just gotten to work," I say. "Gotta go. Have a good one."
I click the button and jam the phone back in my bag. I'm nowhere near best buds, but I can't take any more. What I want to know is what happened to the old snarky boy from high school, my old misfit friend, the one who could make me crack up with his constant sarcastic little asides. More and more, I'm aware that that guy went through some kind of unfortunate cleansing or deprogramming situation. I'm going to have to figure a way to bring him back. In the flower shop that day, I help a woman pick out a bouquet for a man she loved who left her when they couldn't have children, and then he married someone else, and now that other woman just had a baby. And, well, she wants them to know that she is happy for them, that she is genuinely, tragically, fully, and confusedly happy for them. After I make up the bouquet she requests, I make up one for her, too, and pay for it myself. I think she needs it more than the couple, frankly. There's a guy who comes in and tells me proudly that he just proposed marriage to his girlfriend of 9 years, and also today happens to be the day she gave birth to their triplets, and now he wants to send her 3 bouquets of pink roses. He disappears while I'm making the bouquets, and I find him sitting on the floor, his head in his hands, sobbing.
"How do I deserve this?"
he says to me over and over again. And an old woman in a baggy dress and sweater who comes in for 1 red carnation and pays for it with coins. She buys 1 every week, which is all she can afford, she tells me. It's to remember her son who got shot. She tells me about his life and how when he was 5, he told her that he was going to take care of her always when he grew up. A man with laughing eyes orders daisies for his girlfriend and writes,
"I'm going to be with you forever, or at least until I get deported."
I feel leveled by every story I hear. One afternoon, I'm at home, talking on the phone with my mom, who is telling me about the progress in her lifelong argument with my father over which way to hang the toilet paper. She goes with under, when the doorbell rings. When I go to answer it, there's an older, smiling man with deep blue eyes standing on the stoop. He's holding a brown paper bag that seems to be thrashing around in his hand. He takes his other hand to steady it, and I think I hear him talking to the bag. "Hello?" I say.
"Oh, hi. I was just trying to calm the boys down a little bit here."
"The boys?" This may be why a person shouldn't open the door without getting a background check on whoever is standing there.
Sorry, he says. "I'm Harry. I'd shake your hand, but I better hold on to this bag instead. Anyway, I was friends with Houndy, and I don't know why, but I went to his traps today and found these beauties. And I just thought, well, I knew you were living here now, and I thought maybe, you know, you like lobster. And since these were Houndies, really, I'd, bring them over and see if you might want them."
"Oh," I say. This is a relief. "Lobsters! How wonderful!"
"Yeah. Well, they're for you. I feel like Blix and Houndy, they would have wanted you to have them."
He has that same expression that everyone else here has when mentioning Blix and Houndy. Sad, yet smiling, remembering something. I ask him in for a cup of tea, but he says he can't. He points to a pickup running at the curb. A woman waves to me from the passenger seat. So I thank him and take the bag of wiggling lobsters upstairs and wrestle the bag into the refrigerator and slam it shut. I think I can hear them in there, disrupting the eggs and the milk. I text Patrick. Refrigerator is possessed by an alarmingly active bag of sea creatures with claws and tails. A gift from Houndy's friend. Please help.
What nature of help do you wish? Pro tip, I hear that some people like them with drawn butter and lemon.
May I? Could we? I need help with all aspects of this project. Chasing, cooking, eating.
Ah, well, in the interest of being a good neighbor, I invite you to bring your sea creatures down. Also, I believe Blix has some rather formidable lobster pots. We can take care of this problem.
It turns out that there are 4 actual living beasts in the bag when I finally get it down to Patrick's kitchen, and they are not interested in hanging out quietly while we prepare to boil them on the stove. Neither one of us has ever cooked a lobster before, so we call up a YouTube video on how you do it, and we drink a glass of wine to fortify ourselves while we watch it. Apparently, someone has to boil water and then pick up this thing, this animal, and plunk it in the boiling water. It might make a noise when that happens. I take a deep sip of wine. Okay, I'll go back upstairs and make a salad while you plunge the lobsters, and then I'll come down when they're done. He says,
I don't want to plunge the lobsters.
Well, somebody has to.
We sit there, staring at the computer monitor.
There's a crash from the kitchen, and we turn to each other.
They're taking over,
he whispers.
They're going to try to put us in the boiling water.
We've got to go see.
Don't let them lure you into the pot. That's the important thing.
We go to the kitchen in time to see all 4 lobsters scuttling along the floor, waving their claws at us.
What the hell? He says. They're making a run for it. The video did not talk about this part.
I think we're going to have to pick them up, I say. One's gone behind the stove. We have to chase them down. And by we, I hope you know I mean you.
Wait, why me?
First of all, because it's your apartment, and secondly, because I am a known coward, and you're not. Also, they now look like giant cockroaches to me.
Okay,
he says grimly. He puts on an oven mitt and starts running around after them while they clatter along, going in circles. He finally gets one and holds it in midair and does a mock bow.
Now what am I supposed to do with this monster?
Put him in the sink. Or, no, he'll get out of the sink. In the bathtub. It takes 20 more minutes to catch 2 more, and then we have to move the stove in order to capture the 4th, and by then, we're laughing so hard we can't even stand up. And we have a tub full of lobsters that we cannot ever imagine eating. The night's dinner turns out to be pizza, and the lobsters spend a luxurious day and night in Patrick's bathtub until Paco finally comes over and takes them away. I don't work at Best Buds on Friday, which is good because that means that Sammy can wait here every other Friday afternoon for his dad to pick him up for their weekend together. Jessica has to work, and besides, she's never gotten all that good at being nice when Andrew comes to get their son.
Do you think my dad and my mom will ever get back together again? Sammy asks me one day.
I glance at him. He has a nonchalant look on his face behind those huge round glasses, but I can hear the anxiety in his voice. He keeps tapping on the kitchen table with his pencil.
Well, what do you think? I ask, stalling for time. I think they still love each other. They're both always asking me about the other one. My dad goes, how's your mom? Does she mention me? And my mom goes, what did he say to you about the breakup with what's-her-name? Blix said they still love each other. They match, is what she said.
He draws a circle on the table where a drop of milk has spilled.
Really? She said that?
I look at him with interest. They do match, I want to tell him. They absolutely belong together. I'm gratified to hear Blix thought so, too.
Yeah, I think she was going to do a spell or something on them, but, well, then she died.
He shrugs and looks away. Did she do a lot of spells?
Yeah,
he says. Like, one time when I couldn't find my backpack, she snapped her fingers and said we could imagine the backpack, and then I knew where it was. But a few minutes earlier, I couldn't have ever remembered that. So that makes me think she put spells on things.
Really?
Yes, and one time the subway wouldn't come and wouldn't come, and Blix said she had to put a spell on it, and then it came right then.
But she said it like it was kind of a joke, and the subway would have come anyway, you know.
True.
That's why I like coming here and hanging out, because sometimes if I close my eyes, I think Blix is still right here too.
He puts down his glass of milk just so on the table and turns his face to me. His eyes are wide and wise. Like a lot of only children, he's older than his years.
So, do you believe in all that stuff Blix believed in?
Like, what are you talking about, specifically? He looks me over.
Oh, you know.
He waves his hand around.
How she can make stuff happen. Do spells and stuff like that.
I'm not so sure. He gives me an appraising look.
She told my mom that you were a matchmaker. So I think you could get them back together again. How are you going to know if you won't even try?
I don't know, Sammy. I mean, your mom is pretty sure she doesn't want to have anything to do with your dad right now. So maybe we have to wait and see. Not try to change things. You know, if it's meant to be, they'll find their way. Right? He gives me a look that holds so much disgust that I almost laugh out loud.
My childhood is practically over, he says. I'm in double digits already. What if they don't get together until I'm all grown up? That would be the stupidest thing in the whole world.
But isn't your dad living with somebody else?
No, that's the thing. My mom always liked to say that, but he wasn't really. He had a girlfriend who would stay over sometimes. But I think she's gone because I never see her anymore. And when I ask him about her, he gets very quiet. Says it's nothing for me to worry about.
He slumps down in his chair and then looks up at me from underneath his fringe of bangs.
Blix had a book of spells. You could use that. And maybe you'd learn how to do a bunch of stuff. It could help you.
I heard she had a book, but I've never seen it.
It's right over there, he says.
He gets up and points to a bookcase in the corner filled with cookbooks.
This is the book she showed me when she looked up a way to make my sore throat go away.
Sure enough, there's a book called The Encyclopedia of Spells sitting right out there for anybody to see. A book I'd somehow never noticed. The binding of the book has a picture of a vine with red flowers. Frankly, it doesn't look all that legitimate. I think a real book of witches' spells would look secretive with hieroglyphics. You wouldn't be able to read the title from across the room. Just then, the doorbell rings, and he jumps up and grabs his backpack.
Don't tell my dad, he says. And think about it. Read the book. Please, 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 please.
After he leaves, I finish drinking my tea. Periodically, I glance over at the book and think about getting it off the shelf and looking at it, just to see, you know. But something holds me back. I go outside, sweep the stoop, then go get some chicken salad at Paco's Bodega for dinner and find myself watching a lively neighborhood conversation there between the regulars about which kind of people read the New York Daily News and which ones read the New York Post, and whether you can tell the difference merely by looking at people. Paco, in the minority, maintains that you can't, and looks to me to back up his position. I shrug, and he laughs at his mistake.
How are you going to know? You're an incomer, he says. Now Blix, she would have talked all day about this.
Everybody gets quiet. It's as though they're observing a moment of silence for Blix.
She was La Maga, our magician, Paco says softly. And he wipes his eyes.
30. Marnie. I am not a Maga, so I don't pretend to know how these things happen. But two nights later, I'm walking home from Best Buds, and I look up and see Noah approaching the house from the opposite direction. Sauntering, really, that sexy walk, I remember. And the air fills with little crackles of something, and when we reach the front door, my heart is pounding like it's going to shake apart. He takes my hand, and we practically fall inside, mashed against the wall with our bodies pressed against each other, and his mouth hard on mine. All I can think is, oh my God. The door slams, he's closed it with his foot, and the noise of that makes us open our eyes. His hands are in my hair, removing a clip I'd used to pin it up. He says into my neck,
"You've got me crazy. Being near you, but having you no longer in love with me is killing me."
My phone rings right then, and I work it out of my jeans pocket and look at it. Natalie. "Listen, I've got to take this," I say, and he releases me with a groan, and we go inside the apartment, and he heads upstairs to the kitchen. "How are you?" I sit down on the floor and listen as she launches into a litany of complaints. Brian is working too hard. She's lonely at home with the baby. She needs me there. Nobody keeps her company in the daytime. And she's sorry, but she feels betrayed by my decision to stay in Brooklyn, even for 3 months. It's as though we'd reunited and worked out a wonderful plan for our lives, and then I went and changed everything. Backed out. And now she's just heard from Jeremy that I even have a job here. And what is that about? "Listen," I want to say to her, I am falling again." Noah comes back downstairs with a plate of grapes and some cheese. He sits down next to me and starts peeling grapes and dangling them in front of my mouth very suggestively, which makes me laugh.
"This isn't funny," says Natalie. "You didn't even tell me about the job. How come I have to hear it from him?"
Noah starts unbuckling my sandals and easing one off my foot. I'm having a little trouble breathing.
"I have to go," I say to her. "I'll call you back."
And then, well, it's as though we've gone mad, ripping off each other's clothes and then making love right there on the rug in Blix's living room, and it's like no time has passed at all. He's what I've been missing, his mouth and hands and his breath against my cheek, and I have about a million feelings because he's so familiar and exciting, sexy and infuriating. But then it's over. And the second we're finished, as he's rolling off me, it slams into me that I'm the worst person ever. Jeremy's face rises up before me, his eyes wide and hurt, and I hate that I have betrayed him. But you know something? Even as I'm sitting up, grabbing my clothes in the cold air, feeling both guilty about Jeremy and disappointed in myself, there's a big part of me that wants to block out all thoughts and live in this blinding light of a moment. And so I do. I just do. Maybe making love with Noah is something that is bad but necessary. Maybe I'll understand later what I'm doing. Maybe I can't think about it now. Noah stays in my room that night, and the night after that, and the night after that, and the moon outside the window shines on us, and cold air seeps through the cracks where the window sash doesn't quite meet the frame, and branches scritch against the building, like in a horror movie. These are the first really cold nights, and he puts his arms around me, and we lie there each night after making love before sleep overtakes us, and I listen to him breathing and look at the little chip of the moon from my pillow. There's something that felt so inevitable about all of this, like he's an old habit that won't go away. I don't ask myself if it's love or if I can trust him or if this is the right thing to do, whole life-wise. Because it's not. God knows, it's not even close to being the right thing. I feel awful. Here's Jeremy in my head.
You're doing this to me again?
I close my eyes. During the day, I tell myself to stop. I tell myself that this is simply my need to resolve the past before I truly can accept my grown-up life with Jeremy. And maybe this is a little moment in time. Closure. That's it. And I'll get Noah completely out of my system and I can move on. The fact is, this is just a thing I'm doing right now. I'm sleeping with my ex. And like the job at Best Buds, like the house in Brooklyn, like the way the sun slants through the trees that are rapidly losing their leaves, it's all only temporary. A time out of time. I may have forgotten to wonder what Noah's motivation is. And then one night, when I'm nearly asleep, he asks me if he can see the letter Blix wrote to me. You know, just out of curiosity. I am suddenly wide awake, on alert. Little prickles go off behind my eyes, like the beginning of a headache, and I say no. So that's what he's after? Blix's letter? The thought that he may try to use it against me flits across the landscape of my mind.
But why not?
He says. He's propped up on one elbow, trailing his fingers down my arm, tickling me slightly.
I just want to read it. See what my great aunt and my wife had in common.
No, it's private. It was only to me. And please don't forget that I'm your ex-wife.
But she was my great aunt, and she didn't leave me a letter. I feel like, well, I wish I'd gotten to know her better. I'm having a moment, that's all.
I sit up in the bed. Sleep has vanished. He laughs, seeing my face.
Okay, forget it. Forget I even said anything. Go back to sleep.
But of course I can't. He closes his eyes, but I stare at him for so long that he finally opens his eyes and lets out a loud, exasperated sigh.
Marnie, for God's sake, what's with you?
I merely asked if I could... I know what you asked, but it's intrusive and disturbing. You want this house, don't you? That's what this is really about. You think if you read the letter, you can find out something that might mean I shouldn't get the house. That's what's going on. I put my face right down next to his, eyeball to eyeball. He moves back, batting my hands away from him.
Stop it! I don't know what you're even talking about. Yes, you do.
He flops over onto his back and puts his hands behind his head.
Okay, stop being a lunatic and I'll tell you.
He takes a deep breath.
My parents are really perturbed about the way the will worked out, as you know. So, my mom, it was my mom's idea, she thought that as long as I'm here, one avenue we could check out is what Blix said to you in the letter. That's all. She asked me to ask you if I could read it, you know, just to see.
One avenue? One avenue? See, I knew this wasn't all above board. He gets up on one elbow.
Well, what's it to you, really? I mean, you're gonna sell this place. You don't really care anything about it. And I'm not defending my mom because you know I am not 100% in agreement with Wendy Spinnaker about anything. But she said to me that there's at least a chance you're not going to want to stay here the whole 3 months, since you're a Floridian. So they should be on the watch for ways to keep the house from going to a charity. And she wondered if I might just ask you if I could see the letter. Okay?
Uh-huh, I say. Right, sure. I'm surprised she's not rigging the place with booby traps to get me to move out.
Don't give her any ideas.
Now, could we go back to sleep, please? I flop back down on my pillow and spend the next 10 minutes tossing and turning. Finally, I say, Noah, I think I need to sleep alone tonight.
Fine,
he says. He gets up and goes back to his own room, and I close the door behind him and lock it. Then I get the letter out of my purse and sit on the floor reading it again. The letter, Blix's voice, pulls at my heart.
I told you when we met that you are in line for a big, big life. Darling, this is your time.
I sit there for a moment, trying to figure out why I feel so violated. Then I roll up the letter and hide it in the sleeve of my sweatshirt, way at the back of my underwear drawer. 31. Marnie. One morning later that week, the doorbell rings at just past 8. Surely not more lobsters. I have the day off from the flower shop, so I'm still in my bathrobe, losing my daily fight with the coffee press thing, and Noah is choking down a piece of toast and reading the messages on his phone, getting ready to go to class. Of course, we argue about who has to answer the front door. I say he should since he's dressed. He says I should since he has to leave in a couple of minutes. So I go, and Lola is standing there, wearing her marvelous red sneakers and a gray sweatshirt, carrying coffees in a cardboard holder and a bag of something that I'm thinking could possibly be scones or donuts. She looks up at me with a huge grin. "Wow, are you the coffee fairy?" I say. "And does this mean that today I don't have to vanquish the evil spirit that lives in that coffee press? Please, please come in." "Are you sure, dear? Because I don't want to interrupt your privacy," she says. "But today, I just couldn't help myself. I used to come over and eat breakfast every morning with Blix and Houndy. And I just feel like this is where I'm supposed to be." She shrugs. "I know that's not right. This isn't my house, and Blix isn't here anymore, but..." "Stop! Come in! I've been wanting to see you." "Well, if you're sure..." She steps in and looks around, and once again, it's like she's drinking in the surroundings, gaining strength simply from being in Blix's house. Then she turns her eyes to me and says quietly, "Also, I need to talk to you about love, if you have some time." "Love? Sure I have time. Who doesn't have time to talk about love?" Then, wouldn't you know, Noah comes charging out of the kitchen as though the word love summoned him, juggling his coffee cup while he shrugs his way into his backpack, and I see her eyes widen just slightly at the sight of him. Of us. Even though we're not an us, I know we look like it. "Hi, Lola," he says. "Off to school. Marnie, see you later." "Fine," I say, embarrassed. He looks for a moment like he's going to come over and kiss me goodbye. But then he just says, "Keep it real, ladies." And he's gone, slamming the door behind him so hard that the glass rattles. I look over at Lola and her knowing little smile. "Yep, he's still here," I say. "It's weird." "Well," she says, "it's certainly on topic." Noah is not about love. Noah is about the convenience of living here because he's taking classes. "Oh," she says, "you forget that I've learned a few things from Blix." We go upstairs to the kitchen, and just as she's gotten settled in the rocking chair by the window, there's the sound of footsteps on the stairs. Sammy bangs his scooter into the kitchen door, like he does every morning, and I hear Jessica saying, "You've got to stop doing that! Marnie isn't Blix, and she might be sleeping." And he says, "She isn't sleeping, and I just want to say good morning to her." Lola claps her hands. "Oh, I've missed this so much. Sammy heading for school. Ah, it's been way too long." I open the door, and Sammy runs into my arms. Jessica told me that I've inherited him, along with the house. Then he goes over and hugs Lola, too, and Jessica dabs at her eyes and blows kisses, and once we're all hugged and they're on their way, Lola looks at me and says, "So, do you think you love him?" At first I think she means Sammy, but then I know what she really means. "Who? Noah? No, you can't be serious. No." "It's okay if you do," she says.
Love is so complicated, isn't it? You probably had him figured out and filed away, and then look what happened. Blix gave you this house and railroaded you right back with your ex. Damnedest thing in the world. Unintended consequences, I call it.
But I don't love him.
No, but you're sleeping with him, she says. So, there's that.
Oh, God, you can tell?
She nods. So, if I may ask, what happened to the guy back home?
I groan.
He's still hanging in there.
Listen, I'm just bad, I tell you. I was always the good girl who did everything she was supposed to. And now every day I tell myself that I'm not going to have anything to do with Noah again. And then at night, I don't know.
She smiles at me. I get it. You're just having that year of life when you're like a magnet.
Sweetie, you're attracting everything to you. Situations and lovers and life. You're pulling stuff in all over the place.
It's my theory that everyone gets one of those years. It passes. Don't worry.
It's not dangerous? Because it feels kind of awful.
Well, if you stop at 1 year, then it's not dangerous. How old are you anyway?
29.
Perfect. See? You're going to be fine. It'll run its course. Trust me.
She says.
And just so you know, I think Blix approves of this.
I look at her closely while I'm stirring cream and sugar into my coffee.
So,
am I allowed to ask about the man who comes and picks you up? The man with the New Jersey plates? Is that the love you wanted to talk to me about?
She scowls at me.
Well, yes.
But first, you need to know that he's not anywhere close to being somebody I could ever love.
No?
Marnie,
he was my husband's best friend.
So?
She purses her lips.
Can't you see what's wrong with that? I can't believe you matchmaking people. Do you have any scruples?
Clearly I don't, but I don't see why this...
Okay, I'll explain it to you. Blix sent him to me. She told me as much. With all her little tricks and sending out vibes into the universe, whatever, she said she was going to work on finding me a man to love, even though I said I didn't need one. And time passes, and one day, out of the blue, I get a call from William Sullivan. William Sullivan, my husband's best friend, wants to see me, catch up, old times, you know? He has no idea that he's the subject of any kind of vibe being sent out. He just shows up.
I look at her blankly.
And Marnie, this is never going to work because I can't be romantically involved with William. He was like a brother to my husband. Walter and I used to go on family picnics with him and his kids and his wife.
He has a wife?
Had. He's a widower. Patricia, her name was. Perfectly lovely woman. And I am not going to kiss her husband.
Does he want kissing? Maybe he wants a nice friendship, too.
Oh, I don't know. Sometimes we'll be sitting in his car, and at a certain point I can feel his hand start to crawl along the back of the seat in a very suggestive way.
Wait, it crawls?
I am fascinated with everything about this story, and also intrigued with Lola's animated face, turning pinker and pinker, and then the spirals of sparkles distracting me by going off behind her head.
You know how they do, she says. How a man will just snake his hand along the back of the seat, thinking he's being so innocent, but clearly he's intending to put his arm around you, to pull you in. And he gets this shy, sort of sly look on his face.
It's awful. Just awful. I'm embarrassed for him, really.
I burst out laughing.
Lola, really? Snakes? And his crawling hand? Do you hear yourself?
It sounds to me like it might be lovely talking to somebody who knew you from before. He's safe. He knows you. He likes you.
She is glaring at me, so I say, but if you don't want him, then why are we spending so much time talking about him?
Because I saw you looking the other day when he came to pick me up, and I know you're like Blix, and I want you to stop thinking everything you're thinking about William and me. Just stop it. Blix thinks everybody should be like her and Houndy. If you've lost your partner, get another one, as if everybody's replaceable.
Huh, I say. She looks at me. I was happily married for 42 years, and that chapter of my life is over. Who needs it? Who needs the bother of it? I've got my television programs, and my bridge club ladies, and the neighbors who come by, and the people at church. And do I really need to take a chance on some other man?
Right now, I've got everything just the way I like it. I told Blix I don't need another man. Somebody with opinions I'd have to pay attention to.
So, I take it this didn't sit too well with her?
She shakes her finger at me, and there's an explosion of sparks all around her.
Let me tell you something about Blix. Blix the adventurer. I'm quite sure she still thinks that someday she and Houndy and this man, William Sullivan, and I are going to be frolicking around together in the afterlife. And we are so not, because when I'm in the afterlife, I'm going to be over in Walter's corner, sipping tea with him and not having to explain to him that I have a second husband who happens to be his old friend.
For a moment, my mind is boggled with this view of the afterlife in which we're all traipsing around between little bistro tables where our old friends and lovers are drinking their tea and noticing who we're talking to more than them. It sounds so much like eighth grade.
That can't be what it's like, I say.
And don't you really think that if it is, both Walter and William Sullivan will be evolved enough to want to know that you can sit with both of them at the same table in the afterlife? You and everybody else they ever loved?
I think that's what the afterlife is going to be all about. That's when we're finally going to understand all the love stuff that confuses us now. It's going to be magnificent. All the Walters and Williams and Lolas and Blixes and Houndies all together.
I look over at her. All the color has left her face, and in a low, panicky voice, she says,
Monty, oh no, I can't breathe so well, and my heart is...
And then, almost in slow motion, she falls right over. Patrick takes one look at her and says she has to go to the hospital. By the time he gets upstairs, of course, she's come too, and is even arguing about things. She wants to go home and get in bed. But he's not having it. She needs to go to the hospital, he says, find out what's going on.
What could it be?
She says in a wavery voice. She looks so nervous. It's like she's a little child dressed in a grandma costume. Perhaps to be in a play.
Well,
he says,
it could be nothing. Or it could be you drank too much coffee. Or it could be something they'll want to help you with.
He's already calling 911. Our eyes meet, and he smiles at me. She makes little murmuring sounds of distress.
Marnie, are you going with her to the hospital, do you think?
Of course, I say. I know that Patrick can't go. He'd have a meltdown in a medical place, among strangers. He mouths the words, thank you, and then he's talking to the dispatcher. While he's on the phone, she gives me specific directions for what items she needs, and I go next door and get her pocketbook and her warm jacket, both of which just happen to be in her bedroom. No clothing, because she won't be staying. She's positive of that. I love how her house is dark and cool and filled with large pieces of old people upholstered furniture, grandparent furniture. It's like a cave in here, with all the shades pulled down. There are tons of pictures of her and Walter and their two boys set out on every surface and hanging on the walls. Lola with red, fluffy hair cut in layers like petals, and Walter, a slim, handsome man with laughing eyes. The boys looked just like boys of any era, crew-cutted and freckled, wearing striped T-shirts, grinning at the camera, and then turning into handsome teenagers, and finally bridegrooms. And then there are snapshots of them with their families, far away. There's a framed portrait of Walter next to her bed, and I pick it up and look at his aquiline nose, his blue eyes. "Walter," I tell him, "you old rascal, you know as well as I do that you've got to give her a sign you released her, don't you? You and I both know she needs the love and care of your old friend now." When I turn, I notice the little gold sparkles are back, showing up tentatively around the curtains, like little fireflies at dusk. I'm no MAGA, but it does seem to be kind of a coincidence that all those sparkles showed up right when we were getting to the heart of love in the afterlife. I come home from the hospital that evening to find a dog on the stairs, or rather, the stoop. He's lying there at the top, and when I reach him, he stands up and wags his tail and licks my hand like I'm his owner, and he's been told to stay there until I return, and now his whole body is vibrating and saying, "At last, you are here. How did I get so lucky to find you at last, you wonderful, beautiful, kind, elegant creature of love? And by the way, do you know how to operate a can opener?" "No," I tell him. "I am not looking for a dog. I am moving back to Florida in another 2 months, and I can't take you with me." He looks away and then looks back at me. I search through my purse for my keys, glancing over at Lola's dark house. The hospital is keeping her for a few days, so tomorrow morning I'm going to take her a change of clothes, a decent nightgown, and some toiletries. "She'll be fine for tonight," she told me in a quavery voice that had a distinct not-fine undertone. Still, she is being brave. She has a room overlooking the river, and a roommate who likes the same television programs as she does. I sat in a chair next to her and didn't leave until they made me. The dog makes a little sound and licks my hand with his soft pink tongue. I stare at him helplessly. I know exactly nothing about dogs, except that they are dirty and they like to eat things, particularly human shoes. This one is a medium-sized brown and white one with floppy ears and big brown eyes, and when I open the front door, he bounds inside like he knows where the bones are hidden. He hasn't been here for 5 minutes when some switch in his doggy brain gets activated, and suddenly he's dashing through the rooms, racing around in circles, leaping up on the couch and off again, zooming up the stairs, then down again, zigzagging through the bedrooms and back into the living room. I can do nothing but stand by in amazement, leaping out of his way when necessary, and then finally laughing so hard I have to run to the bathroom. Later, because he seems hungry, I go over to Paco's and buy some dog food and ask if anybody might know who he belongs to.
"A brown and white dog with floppy ears? I think he's your dog," says Paco with a laugh. "At least, now he is."
"No, seriously, he's a stray. He hang around here sometimes and then go somewhere else for a while, but he always show up again." "Great. So he's a freelance dog. Available on the open market. Everybody in the store has advice for how much to feed him and how to check him for fleas and ticks. And then, in the back, it turns out, Paco has shelves with dog collars and one leash, so I buy those, too. As well as a water dish and a food dish, a brush to brush him with, just because.
"And I'd give that boy a bath before you let him up on the furniture," says a woman who's carrying a fat, smiling, drooling baby.
So, when I get home, even though I'm exhausted, I fill up the bathtub with warm water and put towels down all across the bathroom floor. I get out my bottle of shampoo and go out in the hallway and say, "Here, boy! Here, boy!" And Mr. Floppy Ears comes crashing around the corner and into the bathroom, where I scoop him up and try to lower him into the tub. He's having none of it. You would think I'd decided to drown him by the way he thrashes around and tries to use my body to help himself climb back out. "It's okay. It's okay," I keep saying, but he's all wild-eyed, panting, and scrambling now to get out of the tub.
churning up the water until I'm hit with a tidal wave so huge that even as it's soaking me, I'm laughing. This doggy, this bath, both are such antidotes to the earnest, business-like, life-saving hospital with all its protocols and forms, all the danger lurking right around the next doorway. "Okay, okay, you gotta stop with this," I say to him, and then clamber into the tub with him, still wearing my jeans and sweater, and he settles right down, as if even he is amazed at such craziness. He stands still then, while I lather him up and scratch his ears, and he's panting, and I'm trying not to get soap in his eyes and scare him even further. Then he gives me his paw, almost like an offering, a handshake of thanks. That's how Noah finds us when he opens the bathroom door. Both of us in the tub, covered in soap suds, the dog with his head propped on the side of the tub, looking contented.
"What the hell?" Noah says. "What is this?"
"This is my new dog. I think I'm going to name him Bedford. It's my favorite avenue, I've decided."
"Wait, you bought a dog?"
"No and yes. I didn't buy him. He picked me, as it turns out. He was on the stoop when I got home, waiting for me. And I do have a favorite avenue. Bedford is everything Driggs Avenue wishes it could be."
"Oh, my God. Who are you, really? I don't even know you anymore."
"I'm me, and I'm giving him a bath so he can sleep on the bed. A lady at Paco's said I had to."
"I'm sorry, but that mutt is not sleeping with me in any bed."
I smile at him, because that's just fine with me. I had already decided today that I am going to try not to sleep with Noah Spinnaker anymore. After he closes the bathroom door, I write my vow in soap on the tile. Not that it shows, but I know it's there. "Bedford," I say, scratching him under the wet chin, "already you are solving so many problems, boy." The next day is Halloween, and when I go to the hospital to visit Lola, I take her some candy corn as well as some clothes to wear. She looks dried out from the hospital air and exhausted from all the tests, but she says she's feeling better. They keep poking her with needles, she says. She misses her houseplants and her pictures of Walter. I tell her that I've somehow acquired a dog, and she says,
"See? Your attraction quotient is at work. You've now manifested a dog for yourself."
"I need to figure out how to manifest you some good health so we can spring you from this joint," I say, and she sinks back among the pillows and says,
"Oh, would you, darling? Let's forget about love for me and just get me some good health."
"Maybe both," I say.
"Just health, sweetie."
Also, there is this. I think the nurse's aide who comes into the room is in love with the guy who brings the wheelchair to take Lola for a scan. I also think the woman in the next bed is in love with her doctor. I wouldn't be surprised if I wandered around the hospital for hours and found so many matches we could hold a dance party on the roof and have everybody paired up. Later that day, I take Bedford to Prospect Park, where we find ourselves partaking in a Halloween street fair farmer's market, clearly attended by every child, parent, and dog in Brooklyn. There are games set up and face-painting booths, an artisanal ice cream truck, a guy selling both organic vegetables and hand lotion. I spend a lot of time looking at a table filled with vintage clothing, candles, soaps, and stained glass lamps. And here I am, just another human who has a dog on a leash, a human carrying a takeout cup of coffee and a phone. And then he is out of sight. The leash slips from my hands when I stop to pick up a bar of olive oil soap, and away he goes. I walk for a bit, then sigh and lie down on the grass. Okay, I think, watching the sky. I had a dog. Maybe this is what life is teaching me now. How to let go. I had a life in California and a marriage. Then I had a life in Florida with a man who wants to marry me. Now I have a moment in Brooklyn with a house and my ex and a guy downstairs who is maimed and claims to be irredeemably misanthropic, And I have a new friend who has a child and a wound where her heart is supposed to be, and an old lady who thinks she can't possibly love again. The gold sparkles are all around me still. If I squint, I can see them. The same ones Blick saw. It makes me feel so close to her, as if maybe she's somewhere nearby, floating about in the ether. After a while, I feel something touching my leg, and then I hear panting and feel hot breath on my face. I sit up quickly and put my hands over my mouth. But Bedford doesn't care that I don't want dog slobber all over my face. He stretches out next to me, wagging his tail, smiling, and his eyes look right into mine. "I'm back," he says. "When shall we head back home? Oh, and by the way, I brought you a baby shoe."
"Please know that I am totally on your side, no matter what is going on upstairs. But is there a cattle drive situation you are living with? Should I be concerned?"
"Oh, sorry. I seem to have acquired a canine."
"You see? I thought it must be a greyhound, but Roy was sure it was a whole pack of wolves."
"LOL. A mutt. Named Bedford. His middle name is Avenue, but that's only used on formal occasions or when he has ripped up all the garbage in the kitchen. Which, by the way, he just did."
"I suspect you are turning into a Brooklynista. There is no other excuse for that name. Fun fact, Roy's original name was Seventh, and Avenue was his middle name, too. Hashtag just kidding."
"Perhaps Bedford and Roy need to meet each other, as the two animals of the house."
"You are so adorable. Cats and dogs don't so much enjoy meeting each other."
"Patrick, would you ever go for a walk with me, do you think?"
"Hey, how is Lola doing?"
"She's fine. They're doing tests, lots and lots of tests." "Patrick, would you ever go for a walk with me?"
"When is she coming home?"
"Not sure." "Patrick, so you never go out?" "Never. At all. How do you get groceries?"
"Marnie, where you're from, do they not have delivery services? It's a wonderful system." "But now, sociologically interesting as this is, I really must get back to work. Toenail fungus is a serious disease, and people are waiting to hear my thoughts."
"Fine. Gotta go, because a stormtrooper is at the door anyway, wanting candy. Hashtag might be Sammy."
"Oh, these quaint customs of people and their children. Pro tip, Sammy is one thing, but if other children come to the door, you don't have to open it for them."
"You are a curmudgeon of the highest order."
"The very highest. A higher curmudgeon you will not find in today's world."
I stare at my phone for a few minutes, wondering if I dare take a chance, say what I want to say. And then I type, "Were you always such a high curmudgeon, or is this because of what happened?"
"Whoa. Good talk. Off to describe toenail fungus. The fun doesn't stop. Ask Roy."
"Look at this magnificent stormtrooper," says Jessica. "At least I get him for Halloween." She's standing in my kitchen doorway, pointing to Sammy, who is all dressed in white with a white helmet. He's carrying a pillowcase full of candy. He says,
"Oh, Mom."
"Well, if Halloween had fallen on one of those alternate weekends, then you would have been in Manhattan with your father and with her. And she, being all of about 24, probably wouldn't know that children even go trick-or-treating, and that they need costumes. Or, who knows, maybe she's so young she still goes herself." She shrugs, both hurting and pleased with herself. "You're my costume person," he says. He looks at me and rolls his eyes, the universal signal of the exasperated child. "Also, Mom, Dad told me he isn't even seeing her anymore."
"Dream on," says Jessica. "This is the relationship for the ages, to hear the way he described it to me."
I interrupt her before she can continue with her tirade. "Come on in. I've made hot chocolate for you. And show me all your loot. Oh, my goodness, you filled that whole pillowcase to the brim." Jessica and I make him spill out his whole sack of goodies on the table. Luckily, it's a huge surface. And for a while, the three of us are laughing and picking through the candy bars and lollipops and bags of M&Ms and toys, exclaiming over everything. We drink our hot chocolate.